Hello and welcome to the Irish History Show on Near FM. My name is Cathal Brennan, and on today's show, my co-host John Dorney and I are very pleased to be joined by Irish-American author, historian and poet John Kearns. On Wednesday the 3rd of July, John will be delivering a lecture in the Sean O'Casey Community Centre in East Wall about the Molly Maguires, and this is part of their series of talks entitled On the Road to the Lockout. If you would like to listen to this or previous episodes of the Irish History Show, you can go to the Near FM podcast page on nearfm.ie/podcast/tag/de-history-show/. Or you can check us out on Facebook on facebook.com/The Irish History Show. John, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Hi, John. We're going to talk about the Molly Maguires, who were an Irish-American secret society. Can you tell us something about the background of why Irish people who came to America would have formed a secret society?
There was a tradition of the secret societies in Ireland, where most of these people had come from. Actually, most of them had come from Donegal, and a lot of people from Western Mayo as well. And I think they had a tradition of secret societies responding to conditions of injustice. One book that I've read called Making Sense of the Molly Maguires by Kevin Kenney. Kevin Kenney uses the term retributive justice. Uh-huh. Where they took direct action against landlords, against mine bosses, or whoever they considered had kind of broken the rules of some sort of social compact that they had. So I think what happened is that the Molly Maguires, the Irishmen that found themselves in the coal fields of Pennsylvania, responded in a similar way, a way that they had been used to back at home. And I think they tried working through unions, and a lot of times they did both. They would follow the traditional union methods of striking and things like that, but then they would also threaten people with violence and sort of fall back on their old ways when the striking didn't seem to work.
Mm-hmm. Now, in Ireland, there's a very long tradition of this. You've got white boys, ribbon men, Rockites, and so forth, right down to the century. What you have is you have intimidation, boycotting of people, retaliation on people who have betrayed the community. Is this what we see with the Molly Maguires? Is this the same kind of thing?
Yes, exactly. It's right in line with that tradition of the ribbon men and the white boys and people day boys and all those secret societies. And so they would send the offending person what they called a coffin notice and sort of warn them, say, if you don't stop doing such and such a thing, then this coffin will be your home. And they would draw a little picture of a coffin on it.
Yeah.
That was exactly it. They responded by taking direct action against most of the victims were, you know, mine bosses or strike breakers or people like that who had somehow treated them unjustly in Pennsylvania.
And you think this is the response of people who distrust authority, who don't expect to get results by the legal channels?
Yeah, I think so. I think there was a tradition of that too. I think it comes from Ireland. I mean, even back to the United Irishmen, they, you know, thinking that taking these extra legal methods to get what they wanted because the law didn't seem to apply to them or the legal methods didn't seem to work for them, as you said.
What was the Pennsylvania like that these Irish immigrants arrived to around the time of the Civil War? Like, what was the ethnic makeup? What type of jobs were available?
There was a very ethnically divided community. There were Welsh miners who had experience mining in Wales. There were a lot of Germans, and then there were the Irish, and the Irish had very little experience with mining, and plus there was a lot of prejudice against them for being Catholic and just generally being this new wave of immigrants coming to America. So the Irish were kind of the low man on the totem pole. So that might have been another reason why they took these extra legal methods, because they didn't think the system was really working for them.
Because we don't tend to think of mining as an Irish profession. When we think of South Wales or the west of Scotland or Cornwall or the north of England, there's this tradition of mining there. Were Irish people viewed as like general labourers in terms of mining? Were they viewed as skilled miners?
Were the Irish?
Yeah.
No, they were usually given sort of the worst jobs, and they were cheated out of the. They were paid less than other people. They were given the worst jobs. There were stories about mine bosses or the people that were counting up how much coal they mined. It would cheat them out of. They would give them a lesser number than what they actually produced for the day. No, they were not seen as skilled at all. I think the Welsh had better skills, and there was a great deal of prejudice against them for being Catholic and being the new wave of immigrants.
You would assume that Catholicism would be this great uniter, that Italians, Lithuanians, Poles, all being Catholics, it would bring them together. But one of the first things they said is that in these communities, the parishes would almost divide up on linguistic or ethnic lines. You would have like an Irish Catholic parish or Italian parish.
Exactly. Yeah, there was, I read the same thing, that there were German parishes and Italians and Lithuanians. So they were very much broken down by ethnic lines, along ethnic lines. I think for a long time, even into the 20th century, those towns in upstate Pennsylvania were very divided.
And was that a real issue, as you spoke there about the whole nativist movement and the know-nothings and that type of anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic political movement that sort of verged on then into anti-labour towards an anti-worker?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I don't know if the nativists played a great role in the Molly Maguire story, but I think that has a great deal to do with the atmosphere of the time. I mean, I used the phrase before, I was saying the Irish were immigrants, but in a sense, they were really refugees, and refugees from the famine, who sort of came into the United States needing a lot of services and help that had not existed before, and also probably causing some problems, too. So I think, the press and was very anti-Catholic, and I think the power structure was very Protestant, and they probably had a nativist influence. So I think it was generally the atmosphere of the time in the press and in the politicians and the mine owners and the railroad owners and people like that.
So we have an ethnically divided workforce in the mines in Pennsylvania, but the conditions for all of the miners were quite bleak by modern standards, certainly.
Yes, I think so. Yeah, I think they didn't have the five-day work week or any of the benefits that we have. They had children that were working on sorting the coal, sorting the good parts of the coal from the bed. So there was child labor, there were long hours. It was a very depressing life. I think in the beginning, I mean, in sort of the 1860s, the beginning of the Molly Maguire story, the miners had a certain amount of independence, and I think there was a way they could probably make a little bit more money than they might have in other jobs. So that might have been one of the reasons why the Irish went to the mines, even though they didn't really have any experience with it. But I think, but later, as there's a character, Franklin Gowan, who was the head of the Reading Railroad, and once he started consolidating power and he wanted to control the mines and the railroad, the railroad that was shipping the coal from upstate Pennsylvania to Philadelphia mm-hmm. or to New York. But as the time wore on, actually the conditions for the miners got worse. Okay. And as that happened, the violence started to increase.
Can you explain that, how the conditions actually deteriorated?
Well, in 1875, they offered a contract. I think it was Gowan offered a contract, which was actually 10 to 20% less than what the miners had been paid earlier. And plus, he had put together a group of, as the workers were unionizing, he also tried to get the mine operators to combine into a sort of union of the owners. And so he was able to, you know, set prices and wages and control things much more over the whole, you know, area of upstate Pennsylvania, much more so than he had in previous years, where there were independent mine owners. Yeah, so they actually lost money. They went out and had a long strike. They actually call it the long strike of 1875. And by the end of that, things started to fall apart, and the people running the unions kind of lost control of some of the union members, and violence started to increase. And then eventually they had to just cave in to Gowan's demands and his contract, even though they didn't want to. But they said they did it just because of the pangs of hunger was really the only reason mm-hmm. they did it. So it was very bleak, very depressing, I think, for them to go through that long strike and that only to end up, you know, accepting a worse contract than what they wanted.
Mm-hmm. Well, it must have been very difficult for union members to keep a strike going when you have this constant influx of immigrants into a community that can drive down the wages and conditions. So there must have been a lot of fights between incoming immigrants who were prepared to work for a lower contract and the established miners already there in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that might have been one of the reasons that caused the tension between the Welsh and the Irish, you know, in addition to the religion and the different skill levels. But I think there was a lot of it was sort of almost like gang warfare. You know, there was just ethnic mm-hmm. battles. The towns were divided, and sometimes they would get into fights about different things. But that probably had something to do with the hostility as well.
And from what I've read, there seems to be some type of social mobility for established miners, like Welsh miners, moving into management and mine ownership, which doesn't seem to have existed for Irish miners.
No, I think what some of the Irish miners did, and some of the men that were actually hanged as Molly Maguire's, were people who had been able to save up enough money to get out of the mining business and open their own pubs and things like that. And so they became publicans and community leaders and people like that. And so one of the reasons probably why they were targets of these investigations and prosecutions.
Now, could you tell us about the Ancient Order of Hibernians and what role they played with the Molly Maguires?
Franklin Gowan, who I mentioned before, was he usually would try to conflate the two, saying the Molly Maguires and the AOH and the actually the Working Man's Benevolent Association, the union, were all one and the same thing. But actually, it really isn't true. I mean, you could look back at the historical records and find that if there were Molly Maguires, they were just a small part of it. The Ancient Order of Hibernians was a Catholic fraternal organization. It said it only accepted people of good character and was working on, you know, friendship and unity, those sorts of things. So they condemned any Molly Maguire violence, and the union did as well. So they all tried to distance themselves from that. But I think there was a small group. I think all the Molly Maguires were members of the AOH, but I don't think, but it didn't necessarily mean that if you were a member of the AOH, you were also Molly Maguire. I think there were a small minority within the Ancient Order of Hibernians.
So this was really used as a stick to beat the AOH with?
Yes, because the church, which was another big player in the story, the church was very critical of the Molly Maguires, and they were also critical of the Ancient Order of Hibernians, because they didn't like the fact that they had secret oaths. Mm-hmm. And so the church really condemned them for that. There's an interesting thing going on, I think, a sociological thing, that I think that Irish America was kind of trying to define itself or redefine itself, and these men who were called Molly Maguires were kind of outsiders to the main part of Irish America. The Irish Americans had become urban, had become traditionally practicing Catholics, English-speaking, and the men who were accused of being Molly Maguires were often Irish-speaking. They were not literate. They had different ways of practicing the religion, some old Celtic customs that had worked their way into the religion, like the wakes and things like that. The church was trying to eradicate in those days with the devotional revolution mm-hmm. that happened here in Ireland, and same sort of thing was going on in America. So they were getting a lot of pressure from Dublin, from Rome, from Philadelphia. So these were outsiders, and so there was an interest in getting rid of these kind of wild Irishmen.
I mean, it's very interesting because the exact same thing is happening in Ireland, and not quite the same way, but you do have the church is against oath-bound organizations, be it the Fenians, be it the AOH, be it the secret societies. And yet, there's also a certain sympathy for them at the same time. Is something similar going on with the AOH and the Molly Maguires? They don't really like what they're doing, but they can't totally disown them.
Yeah, well, I know one part of the thing that was interesting was even though the church had condemned them and it was really kind of couldn't support them at all, when the men were in jail and were about to be hanged, the priests felt that they had to come and comfort them and counsel them and everything, even though they knew they had made statements against them in the past. So they were kind of, having it both ways in that sense, especially toward the end of the story. Because
sure. Well, let's go back a little bit in the story, though. And the Molly Maguires, would it be fair to say, emerged from a period when the workers have been defeated in strikes, when, let's say, open methods appear to have failed and violence seems to be, people see the need to use violence. Would that be a fair assessment?
I think so. Yeah, there were sort of two times when the violence really flared up, and it was sort of in the 1860s, right around the American Civil War, and there was some fighting over the draft and over the conditions there. And then when the people came back from the war, there were more workers looking for jobs and things like that. So there was that period, and then I think the union, when the Working Men's Benevolent Association became stronger, then I think the violence decreased, uh-huh. and people gave the striking a real chance, but then once that long strike started to fall apart, and then once it completely collapsed, then and the WBA really lost a lot of its power, then it's where you see a recurrence of this Molly Maguire violence.
And what did the Molly Maguires actually do? Like, what's their modus operandi?
Well, they would, as I said, they would threaten people with these coffin notices if they felt that a mine boss or somebody was being unfair to the workers, and then. Actually, one of the things they did was they would have men from a different town come and murder somebody, so the witnesses would not be able to tell. And then they would sort of exchange murders. They would go to I'll go to your town and I'll murder your guy, and you come to my town.
Time honored practice in West of Ireland, by the way, at the time. Not now, I should say.
So again, these cultural kind of patterns are reappear. I mean, there's also the whole thing about the Molly Maguires too. It's just it was wildly exaggerated, I think, by the media. The really one medium at the time, just the newspapers. And it was also wildly exaggerated by the prosecutors, who actually Franklin Gowan was one of the prosecutors in court. What the real Molly Maguire violence was and what they actually did, it's very hard to know for sure, because they claimed that there was this reign of terror, that they were, there's murderous thugs were everywhere, and that even when the hangings were about to take place, they said there were hundreds of them in the mountains drilling, they were going to attack and try to save them, and nothing like that ever happened, nothing materialized. So It's hard to really say. So, I mean, this is what they were accused of and what they were convicted of, but I think they, you know, there definitely was some violence. There were about 10 killings. But they say that, you know, before the killings and before the executions and the whole elimination of the Molly Maguires and afterwards, the crime rate stayed about the same. So this reign of terror that, you know, Gowan and Asa Packer and these other industrialists claimed was occurring, doesn't seem to have existed.
Mm, so it's kind of a scapegoat for the people are poor and hungry and there's going to be violence, but instead you blame one particular group kind of thing.
Right, and they associated the Molly Maguires with the union and with the AOH, and so by lumping them all into the same category and hanging 20 of these men, they could kind of eliminate a lot of the resistance and sort of take over the whole coal industry.
It seems very appropriate that you're delivering this talk as part of a series of talks to do with 90 and 13, because there seems to be so many links between this story and the 90 and 13 lockout in Dublin. The employers banding together, the description of workers' militancy as like a small bunch of rabble-rousers leading honest working men astray. The more you're describing it, the more the links seem to become apparent.
Yeah, I think there's a definite link between the long strike of 1875 and the Dublin lockout in 1913, I think. And with similar results, right? I mean, both sort of ended up in defeat for the workers, unfortunately.
Well, there seems to be more working-class solidarity among the miners in Pennsylvania than seems to be led on in some of the written reports. This idea that it's just constant squabbling between ethnic groups. There does seem to be a bit of solidarity there among the miners when a strike or, you know, an industrial dispute does come up.
Yeah, I think they did. I think they did work together in that sense. So they, especially as I mentioned, the long strike. They people in different parts of the coal fields, even though from different ethnic groups, all sort of went on strike at the same time, and there was some movement to only strike when it was absolutely necessary, and to try to accept the deals or work something out without having to strike. But I think the Irish were more likely to go on strike, and they were the impetus, I think, behind the long strike.
I think there's one character we have to get to, and if you could tell us about James McParland, or McParland. What role does he play in the Molly Maguires?
Well, he was a Pinkerton detective who was hired by Franklin Gowan to infiltrate the Molly Maguires and to report on them. So he was kind of the main person that brought these men to trial. He was the main witness that had a lot of them convicted. He went undercover as James McKenna, became a member of the Ancient Order of Hibernians and the Molly Maguires. And he's an interesting character. I mean, his story is kind of is a very dramatic one, you know. And actually, I have a character based on him in my play. I wrote a play called Sons of Molly Maguire, where he plays the role of, you know, spying on people at the same time, but he's kind of sympathetic to them as well. Parlin himself, I mean, he's kind of a suspect character because later on in life he was involved in a similar investigation in Colorado, and he was put on the witness stand, and Clarence Darrow, who was a famous lawyer at the time, apparently just tore him apart and really called him a professional liar and all this, and he was really kind of discredited. But the Molly Maguires unfortunately didn't have Clarence Darrow as their defense attorney. So there's also some question about whether he knew about some of these murders in advance and he could have stopped them. Oh, he did know them about them in advance. He claimed that he wasn't able to stop them or warn the victims. So was he part of the plot? I mean, actually having these people murdered so that he could bring these so-called Molly Maguires to trial, or was he actually just trying to stop crime? There's some definite questions about this James McParland.
Well, again, you can't help but be struck by modern day parallels in Ireland and in the north of Ireland. But we'll leave that just for today. How long did James McParland spend in the Molly Maguire societies in Pennsylvania?
I think it was a couple of years. I think it was about 2 years or so.
Mm. And on his testimony, how many people were tried for Molly Maguire offences?
Well, there were 20 altogether that were hanged. There were 10 in one day, which is the biggest mass execution in U.S. history.
And solely on the testimony of James McParland?
Primarily, yeah. Primarily, he was the biggest witness. There were other witnesses as well, but he was the main reason why a lot of them were convicted. Mm-hmm. It was based on his word.
It seems somewhat scanty evidence.
Yeah, but I think they had, I mean, the trials themselves were grossly unfair, I think. There wasn't a single Irish Catholic on any of the juries. Some of the jurors were were Germans who didn't speak much English or any English. And Gowan was the prosecutor and the railroad, the president of the Reading Railroad. He brought in a special judge who was known as a hanging judge. So it was really kind of orchestrated to come up with a conviction. And it was very difficult for them to defend themselves.
Can you tell us a little bit about the defendants, who they were?
As I said, a few of them were leaders of the community, and so I think they were seen as maybe people that were encouraging unions or encouraging fighting back against. And also, they owned pubs where people would gather to talk about these things and maybe to organize. And so, one of them was named Jack Kehoe, who was known as the King of the Mollies, and another one was Alec Campbell. And there's an interesting story about Alec Campbell. He supposedly, when he was right about to be hanged, when he was taken out of his cell, he put his hand on the floor, and then he slapped it up against the wall, and he said, "It says, today I die an innocent man, and here this mark on the wall will prove it." And he slapped his hand on the wall. There was a handprint on the wall, and the handprint is still there to this day. So that was from 1877.
How did his handprint prove that he was innocent?
I don't know. I guess the fact that it would stay there and would not fade away.
Okay.
But Alec Campbell was a tavern owner, and so was John Kehoe, and he was also a leader of the AOH. So those are two of the most prominent ones. And Kehoe was eventually pardoned by the governor of Pennsylvania about 100 years later, 1970s. and a lot of the men, when they were taken to the gallows, I mean, even after they had gone to confession and had last rites, they still stood in front of the people and sort of any reporters that were there and said, "I'm an innocent man." Some of them did admit, well, there was one or two that admitted guilt, but the rest of them also they were innocent, and even though, you know, they were about to die. So,
well, wasn't there an issue that the governor might pardon them just before they were executed?
Yes, they were expecting that. I think actually Alec Campbell, the man who slapped his hand up on the wall, they were expecting he might be pardoned at the end. He had a lot of support from the community, and apparently there was a huge wake after he died that went on for days. and a lot of people spoke in Irish at the wake just so that reporters would understand what they were saying.
Mm-hmm. And did the Irish community have much political power in Pennsylvania that they could bring to bear on the governor?
Well, yeah, that was one of the things that John Kehoe had been instrumental in helping the governor at the time to be elected. He actually, I think the Irish had traditionally voted Democratic, and they switched, went to the Republican governor. So he was kind of expecting that maybe since he had helped out the governor himself, that maybe the governor would save him. But I think there was just too much pressure on him. He delayed apparently signing the execution orders, and so much so that, you know, Gowan and the other people were getting worried. But I think he felt there was some, that certainly the trials had been questionable, and that there was some doubt about whether these men should really be hanged.
One of the quotes I read there was, "It was a private trial. The state just provided the courtroom and the gallows."
Right. That
sort of seems to sum it up there at the time.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, yeah. It was really something that was orchestrated by Franklin Gowan. I mean, he brought in the judge. He was the prosecutor. They made sure that the jurors, you know, were unsympathetic and not even speaking English. And also the other thing was the newspapers. There were about 25 newspapers that were covering the trials and the hangings and everything, and they were all sort of hysterical about, you know, these ruffian immigrants who were, you know, causing this reign of terror throughout upstate Pennsylvania.
How exceptional was the number of hangings?
Well, there were 10 in one day, and there were four, I think, in Pottsville and six in Malchunk, which is now called Jim Thorpe. So there were the biggest mass execution in U.S. history. Mm-hmm. And then over the next year or two, there were 10 more people that were hanged.
I mean, during or just after the American Civil War, Lincoln had a lot of Indians hanged in one of the Midwestern territories, not a state at that time. But they were outside of state law, I suppose.
Oh, maybe, yeah.
But this would certainly have been the biggest mass execution of citizens, if you like.
It's true, yeah.
So we're just going to take a quick break there for a moment, and we'll be back with John Kearns in part two.
20 Molly Maguires were hanged. How did the Irish community feel about this? What was their reaction to so many hangings?
Well, I think they were outraged. As I said, there was this huge wake for Alec Campbell. There was actually a big march that, as they were taking his body away from the jail. there were hundreds, and it turned into, I think, 1,000 people that marched down the street, marched away, and then had this big wake, which the people, the newspapers at the time thought was outrageous, that people were celebrating the life of this criminal, and they thought the Irish don't understand justice, they don't understand the law, and all these kinds of things. So there's a great deal of prejudice in the media, but yeah, I think they were outraged, I think they were shocked, and I think but things got very quiet, though, in, as far as labor relations in Pennsylvania for a while. So I think Gowan got what he wanted to a certain degree, because there were more strikes and everything that took place afterwards, but Pennsylvania remained quiet. So I think there was outrage in the community, but I think in a sense they kind of went underground. They were sort of cowed by it, I guess. And I think they were probably, the Irish American community in the bigger cities were probably embarrassed by all this, embarrassed by these men who, you know, were seen as wild and dangerous and then all the hangings. So, you know, there's people that have campaigned over the years, you know, for justice for them also. And I mean, finally, 100 years later, one of them was pardoned. And there were some people that think that the whole thing was a fabrication, that there was never was a Molly Maguire's, that it was all just made up by the mine owners. But I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. There was some violence, but there was also, but it was never as big as a conspiracy as they thought.
That's the thing, really. It was a violent period,
right?
And especially a mine town in rural Pennsylvania, you would expect some level of violence.
Right. I think some of it was just, you know, people on payday getting drunk, and there were Welsh people and there were Irish people, and they were hanging around, and somehow they got into a fight, and somebody blamed it and said this was a Molly Maguire crime, but it might have been just, you know, drunken people on a Friday night. Mm-hmm.
So did, just out of interest, did Franklin Gowan become a hate figure to Pennsylvania workers the way that William Martin Murphy did in Dublin?
I think so. I think he's not remembered very fondly, and he was successful for a time. I think he was successful in eliminating the Molly Maguires, but I think later on in life he became very paranoid. He thought that the sons of the Molly Maguires were going to come and get him, and he was going to be hunted down, and eventually shot himself in a hotel room in Washington, D.C. Mm. So he eventually had to give up his dream of uniting the railroad and the coal mines, and he went back to just being a lawyer, and I think he was just disappointed that he wasn't able to achieve to build this empire he wanted to, and he eventually killed himself. So his life didn't end happily either.
Well, I mean, in terms of, we spoke about how when the open methods, the legal methods of organization advanced, there was less of violence, less secret societies, and vice versa. When the legal methods failed, people resorted to secret societies and violence, clandestine violence. How did things develop in Pennsylvania? Did the violence lessen and union management disputes become more regulated?
Yeah, I think the Working Men's Benevolent Association kind of collapsed after that strike in 1875, but there were new unions that came along later, and I think they were more united with other miners in other states as well, so I think it became a much bigger thing. And I think also just the whole issue of organized labor became more acceptable to society. I think part of that was, you know, the reason why the Molly Maguire suffered the way they did is that this, you know, unionization and all the striking was something new, and that was something suspect, and then they tried to paint it with an even worse brush by calling them violent and terrorists and all the rest. So,
what's remarkable how acceptable it seems to be that, you know, young children could work, and not only that, be killed in industrial accidents. Not that anyone thought it was okay, but it seemed to be. Well, that's just the way the world is when you read some of that stuff.
Yeah, it is. It's shocking, isn't it?
It's a period where there wouldn't be any sickness benefits, or if you were seriously injured on the job, your family couldn't really expect much compensation, really, could they?
No, it was very difficult for them. And I think when they went on strike, it was even more difficult. I mean, they had children to feed and things like that. And you know, they had strikes that went on for a few months. And so it was very difficult. Yeah, and They had cause to fight back, and I mean they were treated very unfairly. The conditions were bad, and the pay was low. And then from time to time, the owners would cut it if they wanted to.
I mean, in this part of the world, we're very familiar with the mines over in Britain, in Wales, and north of, as Colin was saying, in Wales and north of England and in Scotland, which have mostly closed now, after these big battles they had in the 1980s, basically just closing them all down. Mm-hmm. Are there still mines in Pennsylvania?
No, I don't think so. I don't think there's very much mining going on.
They've gone the same way, yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And is there still any memory and popular memory of the Molly Maguires in that era in the locality?
I think so. Yeah, I think that handprint of Alec Campbell is still a tourist attraction. I think in the area there are some pubs named Molly Maguire and things like that. So there are some people and it's remembered. And I heard when I was growing up that if you went to upstate, I grew up in Philadelphia, which is not too far from that area. But I heard that if you went up and asked any questions about the Molly Maguires, you wouldn't get much of a response. Nobody wanted to tell you anything. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it's still that way, but it was that way in the 1970s anyway.
Sure.
But I presume that James McParland is quite the unpopular figure in Irish-American folklore.
Yeah, I think anyone who's familiar with the story would see him as a villain. I mean, he was an informer. He was the worst sort of person you could be.
Yeah.
Apparently, he must have been kind of a charming character. I mean, he worked his way into these inner circles, and they said he could, he could dance an Irish jig, and he could buy people drinks. And I guess he had money, from the Pinkerton detectives, and he was able to work, and also he could read and write. So they made him a secretary of the Ancient Order of Hibernians. So he was obviously a very devious character as well, and they thought he was a liar and a murderer, and all the widows, called him that in the courtroom. I mean, the women who became widows later.
Yeah.
A couple of weeks previously, you would have been their best friend or the best friend of their husband,
right,
in their house. Wasn't he engaged to one of the men's sisters?
Yeah. And there's the movie, the Molly Maguires, with Richard Harris and Sean Connery. And then in my play, called Sons of Molly Maguire, I sort of worked that story into that too. That he's also has this girl who's falling in love with him, and he's extremely devious. I mean, even in my play, I had him give her the letters to drop into the mailbox. Can you mail these for me? And the audience knows that the letters are his reports back to Gowan. But
I mean, again, it's amazing how familiar this is. We had Shane Kenna, who's a historian of the Fenian movement in the 1880s, and talking about informers, infiltration, all this kind of thing. But what struck me as well was, as you said, there's also, in Irish America, there's a tension between, these wild traditional rebels and mainstream Irish America, which wants to be part of the establishment in the United States.
Yeah, I think the Irish were becoming more, were working their way toward the middle class at that period of time, about 1877. I mean, the Irish were practically running New York City, probably. And, I mean, they've become the police, the fire departments, the teachers, the school teachers. I mean, I think they've moved into a lot of, at least stable jobs, and I think maybe they wanted to leave this wild past behind them to a certain degree.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, the irony is that in Ireland of that time, let's say Irish Catholics still couldn't have dominated those professions, but they could in the United States, so there's a big motivation to assimilate, if you like.
Yeah, I think in the nearby cities of Philadelphia and New York, I think you had a lot of assimilation going on. And even, I think, probably the mainstream of people in the coal region also, we're not part of this Molly Maguire violence or anything. I think it was a small group of people that just was blown out of proportion by the newspapers and the mine owners.
Well, as you said there about your play, it must be a fascinating subject, a really rich subject for a playwright to delve into.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of drama, I think, in the story. Like I said, the story between the detective and the girl who's he's falling in love with. There's the tension there, and also becoming friends with these men that he knows he's going to have to testify against and have them killed. And one of the things I tried to do in my play was to talk about just the whole idea of history and remembering and how we really don't know what's happened, because these men. The problem is that all the written records were written by people who were against the Molly Maguires and against the Irish and against the Catholics, and so the men themselves didn't really leave anything. Most of them were illiterate, or they were Irish-speaking, or they couldn't, write well in English. So it's really a very one-sided set of documentation that we have. So in some ways, you'll never know the actual truth about what happened. So I tried to deal with that in the play as well, about how there's the dramatic story, which is the whole myth of the Molly Maguires, but then there's, the facts often conflict with the myth. And again, the one-sidedness of the documentation really leaves us with a mystery at the end.
What type of reaction did you get from say specifically an Irish American audience to the play?
I was happy that it did very well. We had some very good audiences. I was flattered that it was part of a festival, and my play was chosen to be on the main stage of the festival, which I was very happy about. And we got good crowds, and I think people were very moved by the story. I think they're moved by the scene with between the James McFarlane character and his girlfriend, and also by the stories of the hangings at the end. I think people were kind of outraged by what happened. Maybe a lot of people weren't that familiar with the story. I think people in Pennsylvania are familiar with it, but I don't think the New Yorkers really knew much about it. So they didn't really know what much about it before they came in. But it wasn't simply a play where you could sit back and say, I'm going to learn what happened to the Molly Maguires. I was trying to question things and question the way that the story is told and question the story that we've received and see, is this really what happened? Will we ever know what happened?
And that's always one of the most difficult things in history, of course, because, you know, the cliche is that the victors write history, but regardless if that's true, the powerful people write history. So, and even when people are being charged with crimes, I mean, the statements get written by the police in Ireland, by the Gardaí. So, I mean, the sort of bias of documents is always a problem in any, when you're trying to figure out what happened in any situation, I think.
That's true. And this case happens to be a little bit more extreme because it's the Mollies didn't leave any records at all. The records that were written were extremely biased from our point of view. I mean, if you look at it by today's standards, I don't think anything like that would be written about an ethnic group today.
And how did this affect politics or even popular politics in Pennsylvania? Would you ever have candidates like referring to their opponent as a Molly Maguire, or would the Irish community in, say, Irish Democrats in Pennsylvania feel any connection to the Molly Maguires, or if you mention them or anything like that?
I don't know if they would today, but I think for years afterwards, I think it had more of an effect on the organized labor. Whenever they tried to unionize or stuff like that, they would be damned as Molly Maguires. And I think, if a politician was supporting unions, they would be supporting Molly Maguireism or something like that. I don't think it would come up much today.
Another thing in Ireland in the early 20th century was that the Ancient Order of Hibernians and the Irish Party sort of mob street fighters would be called Molly Maguires by their opponents. Their separatist opponents would belittle them as Molly Maguires, yeah. So in Ireland, it lives on for about 50 years afterwards.
Really?
It's true.
Particularly in Cork.
Particularly in Cork, where they used to, at election time, the rival nationalist parties used to beat each other up, and one of them was derisively nicknamed the Molly Maguires.
Well, there was a Molly Maguires secret society in Ireland, but there was no... I don't think there was any connection between... So I think the one in Pennsylvania was formed independently. And that was another thing they were accused of. They accused that this was an organization that was imported from Ireland right into Pennsylvania, and they said there was this mysterious Board of Erin, which the Mollies were reporting back to. And so there was also this foreign influence was coming into Pennsylvania that, that was criticized as well.
I suppose at the same time there would have been a bit of fear, wouldn't there, among some sections of America that Irish America and Union veterans who had been involved in the Fenians could actually drag America unwittingly into a war with Britain through the invasions of Canada and different schemes they had employed.
Yeah, so I think there was some fear of that. I mean, there were Fenians that did try to invade Canada, and some of the Irish went into the American Civil War just to get military experience so that maybe they could come back and fight against Britain. But there's also a standoff between the miners and the Molly Maguires in upstate Pennsylvania and the Union troops. At one point, when they wanted to have the draft, they were going to send. I think Lincoln was going to send a battalion of soldiers or whatever to upstate Pennsylvania to make these people sign up for the draft. And then apparently he stopped them. He said they had enough bloodshed between Americans killing Americans. They thought. So, and also there was the draft riots of 1863 in New York, and so
which the Irish were heavily involved in,
right? Exactly, because apparently if you had $300, then you could get out of the draft, and most of the Irish didn't ever have $300 at that time.
So, if we return back to the popular perception of it, one of the things you mentioned there was the Sean Connery movie. Now, it would probably be something that not many people would have seen because it's good. What? 40 years old now at this age or more.
Yeah, I think it's 1970, 69 or 70. Yeah.
So it's due a remake.
It's true. Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of potential for drama in this story. I mean, like I said, the myth is probably the most dramatic story. I mean, the whole story of the detective going undercover and finding the criminals, and then the murders themselves, how they exchanged murders from town to town, and I think there's still plenty of potential for another movie.
Well, how do you feel watching it as somebody who's studied the trials and studied the Molly Maguires? Can you enjoy the film, or are you driven mad by all the plot holes?
Well, I think I watched it as I was working on the play too, so just to see what what someone else had done with this story. I guess I was a little frustrated that it spends a lot of time on the love story and doesn't really get into that much detail about it. And I don't think it really shows that much about the injustice that they suffered. You know, I think it shows them blowing up trains and things that were kind of not really accurate, but. So it's frustrating on that level, yeah. But I think it's a better movie than what was reflected in the box office, because I think it's a famous box office flop.
Okay. In terms of academic history, has much been written about the Molly Maguires?
Yeah, there's been a certain amount. The first few books were extremely biased. I think the first one was written by Gowan himself. He wrote... okay. again, he was controlling the whole story. And most people who followed that sort of followed that same line of thinking. Right up until the in 1950s. And then there's a recent book by Kevin Kenney called Making Sense of the Molly Maguires, which really takes a balanced and sort of much more academic study of the whole story. And it gets into all this detail about where exactly they came from, what the truth of the situation, how many what murders were actually committed, and what can we actually what were the forces that were in society that were lined up against the Molly Maguires, and so that's I think by far the best book on the subject, because the rest of them sort of they get involved, they get drawn in by that dramatic story of the undercover detective and all the hangings and everything like that, so. I think it's due more. It could have more, serious academic study.
I mean, if someone was to research it further, what do you think would be fruitful areas for people to research?
I guess if you could somehow go back and find out if we could prove the innocence or guilt of these men. Is it what exactly were they? Did what was their involvement? What were they actually guilty of? Because it's been very difficult for people to determine. How much did they? I mean, there was one book. It's called A Molly Maguire Story. It's written by Patrick Campbell, who was the grand nephew of Alec Campbell, who was hanged. And he went back to try to see if his grand uncle was innocent. And he finally gave up and said he was not able to determine one way or the other. But he did feel that by legal standards, he should not have been convicted. That was clear.
Yeah, I mean, something that I kind of alluded to earlier is that. Convicting somebody, certainly executing somebody on the testimony of an informer or an agent provocateur is always a very, let's say, suspect way of securing a conviction.
Yeah, it was very, and they did rely heavily on the testimony of James McParland, and they did bring in enough of other evidence as much as they could, but I think he was the prime witness.
Did you ever find out if he felt any guilt about what he did?
They say that he got very paranoid toward the end of his life, thinking that the Mollies were out to get him.
But no actual guilt.
I don't know. I don't see much evidence. He continued doing it. He went out to Colorado and got involved in another investigation very similar to this one, where he went undercover among the miners in Colorado and testified against them later. So apparently not. I mean, I don't know how he was able to do that without feeling guilty, but...
I think one of the things we were talking about there about writing about the Mollies at the time, one of the interesting things was the Pinkertons actually, as a form of self-publicity, used to write about their cases, didn't they?
Yeah, and that was the first accounts came from, I think the Alan Pinkerton published a book about the Molly Maguires, and of course making McParland into this great hero. Yeah, some very strange practices, I guess, if you think about it, things we wouldn't tolerate today. Like I said, in the media and in the and and just even the as you said, the private, was it a private trial and public execution? Yeah.
But it seems to be part of a wider fear that sometimes springs up, particularly in relation to labour issues, of the fear of the immigrant radical in America. It seems to be like a constant issue decade by decade in America.
Yeah. And the sad thing is, I mean, it's very sad that it seems like, you know, history is repeating itself in a certain sense. I mean, because you could call somebody an Islamic terrorist and suddenly they're just, they're guilty. and actually, in the Molly Maguire story, the word terrorist is thrown around all the time. These men were called terrorists. And it's funny that even back then, that was such a powerful word. And so, yeah, sadly, I mean, a lot of these issues that are in the story, and this is one of the reasons why I wanted to write the play, is that the issues of terrorism, the media, the corrupt courts, and all these things are, you know, things that still go on today, especially, you know, in the U.S. since September 11th. Mm. So some very questionable practices, I guess, still going on, or they come back again, sadly.
So is there any plans to run the play again in Pennsylvania anytime soon?
Yeah, I'd love to do that. I think a Pennsylvania audience would really get a lot out of it, because I said they would be much more familiar with the story than New Yorkers are. I'd love to do it again. I mean, it was we did it in a festival where we had, you know, sort of a time limit, and you had to, you know, get in and out of the theater quickly after, you know, so the next show could come in. So it was tough in that sense to tell this big story, this, you know, story within those constraints. So I'd love to do it again with where we had the theater all to ourselves and could set up a really good stage and a set. I mean, and also to get some more Irish actors. We had basically one Irish actor in the cast.
Irish speakers, maybe, no?
Yeah. Well, they had to learn. I have a little bit of Irish in the play, because there's a poem that the characters recite about being the sons of Molly Maguire and the connections between Ireland and Pennsylvania. And one of the things I found really interesting was, kind of inspired me to write the poem, was that apparently the turf in Ireland is just sort of a younger stage of the coal that people were mining in Pennsylvania. So it's basically, it's kind of the same material, just at a different stage of development. Anyways, there's a poem that's part of the play, and the characters say, "Ni hugan on shock don shong," which is the well-fed doesn't understand the hungry. They had all the characters, one of the actors would repeat that line. So I had to teach them the little Irish.
how did they get on with that?
They did fine. Yeah, we actually got we brought in an accent coach to help people to learn the Irish accent, and they did a good job. I mean, I'm kind of sensitive to that myself. I would like to hear it with the real Irish accent. I can tell that it's fake. You know, sure. Yeah. No matter how well they do it.
Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of the show, and we really appreciate you coming in, John. That's John Kearns.
Thank you very much. I'm thrilled to be here.
It was great to have you. John is an author, historian, and poet, and on Wednesday, the 3rd of July, John will be delivering a lecture in the Sean O'Casey Community Centre in Eastwall about the Molly Maguires. If you're listening to this after the 3rd of July, I'm sure somebody will have recorded the audio and put it up online, so you'll probably find it there on Google. On behalf of myself, my co-host, John Dorney, thank you very much for listening. And if you go to the Near FM podcast page, you'll be able to listen to this and previous episodes of the show. Thank you.